The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And good morning and welcome to this May 16th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast, and we are celebrating our fund drive. Barbara DeMarco Barrett and I, Marie Stone, are both here together. Good morning, Barbara.
Hello.
So we are taking your calls for the next hour, and we're taking your calls all week, but particularly in the next hour. We were fortunate enough to get four callers last week. We want to beat that this week. We want to get it up to at least five, perhaps 10. We have gift certificates to give away. We have two gift certificates to Laguna Beach Books, one to Lido Books for $25. For your $50 donation, we have a ton of books that we can offer you. We have gift certificates. We have KUCI swag. So this is your opportunity to give back. We've been doing this how long, Barbara?
20 years.
And
every week. We've been volunteers for 20 years.
What?
That's true.
So we've been bringing authors their wisdom, their advice to you for decades, two decades. And so anyway, this is your chance to give back. So Barbara is here. The number is 949-824-5824. That's 949-UCI-KUCI. And she wants to hear from you.
So, I want to hear from you. Yeah. I'm alone out there.
She's lonely, and we want to get the phones going. So that's that. I am here this morning with Claire Fuller, and in the second half, I will be here with Mark Sarvis. But Barbara will be taking your calls. Claire Fuller gained a degree in sculpture from Winchester School of Art, then went on to have a long career in marketing and didn't start writing until she was 40. She's written two novels, Our Endless Number Days, which won the Desmond Elliott Prize, and Swimming Lessons. She has an MA in creative and critical writing from the University of Winchester and lives in Hampshire, England, where I assume she's joining me from this morning. Claire, welcome.
Oh, yes, I'm here in Winchester.
Well, welcome, for all the way from across the pond.
Thank you. Yes.
So I love these stories of successful writers coming relatively late to the craft in life. I can say that because I'm even later. So before we dive into Swimming Lessons, so to speak, I'd love to hear about that, if writing had always been in your mind or kind of how you came to it.
It hadn't. I'd never thought about being a writer at all. I wrote stories at school, but after I left, didn't do that at all. But I was always a reader, and wherever I lived, would go to my local library and take out as many books as I could and read voraciously. And I think because I loved books so much, I thought that you must have to be really special to be a writer and a different kind of person than I thought I was. So it never really occurred to me. I thought that books were really, they kind of came out whole or something. But now I've learned that an awful lot of it is in the editing. So when I was 40, I'd been doing some art projects with my husband, things that kind of challenged us and made us feel uncomfortable. But then after we'd done them, felt really great about it. So one of those is I discovered in my local library a what was called a short story slam, where you could sign up to write a short story that lasted for the last 5 minutes, and you read it out to a paying audience, and they voted on their winner, which was a really scary thing to do for me when I hadn't written anything since I'd left school. But I did it, and I didn't win for a very long time. But finally, I did win, and by then, I was kind of hooked on writing. And that's when I signed up to do my MA, and I wrote my first novel on the MA.
That is interesting. It's funny because I talk to a lot of writers and other artists about how visual art and other arts kind of feed their writing. Or, you know, I mean, my husband's a photographer, mm-hmm. and we have a lot of cross conversations about voice and about point of view and about light and dark and balance and all of that stuff. And I was wondering if that background in sculpture, do you think, or other arts, do you think has any role in your writing?
Lots of people ask me that, and actually I don't think it does. For me, they are two completely different disciplines and they don't really cross over. But I think having that, just wanting to make something, whether that's a sculpture or a drawing or a piece of writing, it is about craft and it is about creating something. And I can kind of see some similarities with how I work. So when I've done stone carving, I don't really know what I'm going to do. I just start carving, and if something comes out of it that I start to like, I follow that direction. And I write in very much the same way, without a plan. So I think maybe I am, those two things are kind of crossing over, but I don't, certainly don't use the art to inform the writing or the other way around.
I love that idea, though, of letting your subconscious maybe do most of the artistic work and then kind of see what emerges from it. You know, starting out with a plan, I think, is a little dangerous for writers. I think it can look a little contrived, or the reader is on to you if you already know what's in your mind.
Maybe, yeah. I love the journey of discovery as I'm writing, although I also find it very difficult, a kind of scary position to be in when you don't even know what word is going to come next, let alone what the characters are going to do next. So sometimes I am a bit jealous of those people who have a plan, because I think, it must be quite calming to know, well, the next scene will be this, and then it will be this. But also maybe a bit dull to know what's going to happen.
Right. Yeah. I think so, too. So let's get into swimming lessons. For our listeners who are new to the novel, take us inside into Flora and Ingrid's world and talk about the novel.
Yeah. So it's set in Dorset, which is a county in England by the sea. And it's a story, really, two separate strands to it. But the main one for me is about Ingrid. And she writes letters to her husband, Gil, about their marriage as she sees it, how their life together. And instead of sending them to him or giving them to him, she hides them in the books that he collects. And he collects thousands of books. He has thousands of books in his house for their marginalia and for the things that people leave behind in books rather than the content of the book. And after she's written her last letter, she disappears for Dorset Beach, and nobody knows what's happened to her. So there's a strand of the letters, and then interspersed with these is the strand of Flora, who is one of her daughters, her younger daughter, who I think is 21, 22, when she comes home because her father has had an accident. And this is 12 years after Ingrid has disappeared, and Flora starts finally wanting answers to what happened to her mother. She starts asking questions and trying to understand her family a little more without realizing that actually the answers are still in all the books that surround her in the house.
Tell me about the inspiration for this, kind of the point of origin for you. Did it start with a character? Or did it start with an idea?
Mainly it started with the character. It started with Gil, the father and husband. I'm in an online writing group called Friday Fictioneers, and an American woman posts a photograph and then online on her website, and then writers from around the world write 100 words inspired by that photograph, 100-word story. And this is quite a few years ago. She just posted a photograph of a beach. I think it even had palm trees, which we don't really have in Dorset. But I wrote about this man walking along this beach and finding things that were washed up. And he walked to his house, and then I started describing his house. And I was just quite intrigued by him and the location. And so I carried on writing, and that's really kind of the germ of it, starting from Gil's point of view. And I wrote about 20,000 words from his point of view. And he's quite a difficult character for people who haven't read it. He's not particularly likable, which makes me actually like him more. But but because he's very difficult, I thought, actually, I don't want to hear from you anymore. And so I deleted nearly all of those words. And all that remains is the prologue from his point of view. And that's mostly how it started. But there was another bit, if you want me to tell you about that too.
Yeah.
but as part of these projects, these kind of slightly art projects that my husband and I were doing before, this is before we were married, and he lived in a flat about 50 miles away from my house, and we decided we would write notes to each other. We hadn't long met, so I guess they were love notes, and we hid them in each other's houses, and I hid one behind his mirror and in a saucepan he didn't use and things like that. And then when we decided that he would sell up and move in with me, he found all five notes that I'd written to him. But now it's 10 years later and there are still two notes in the house that we share together I haven't found. And he's a librarian and I'm a writer, and I'm absolutely convinced they're in the books. We have thousands of books. These two notes are lost. He says he knows where they are, but I almost don't want to know now. Yeah. It's been so long. I don't want to find them. You know. So that was part of the inspiration for Ingrid hiding her letters in Gil's book.
It's funny because right before I read this novel, I heard a story. I don't know if it was on This American Life or where. I can't remember where I found it now, but it was about a woman who is such an avid book collector in bookstores. She goes to use bookstores because of all of the things that she finds in her book, in these books. And she's found the same thing. She's found love letters. She's found photographs, postcards, just sales receipts, random stuff. And there's something so intimate about books, and then about the idea that you've shared this kind of intimate space with a stranger before, and what, you know, and the memorabilia that you tuck inside. There's something so compelling about that, and I was trying to analyze what exactly it was that was so compelling, but
it is really compelling. It's having some connection with a stranger, and that you'll never meet, probably won't ever know who that is, and to me it just makes me want to tell stories about who they were. It's just a funny little snippet of someone else's life. You know, if it's a bus ticket, you can kind of see where they traveled, or if it's a theater ticket, what they went to see, or birthday card or something. I don't know. Yeah, it's something really compelling about having that tiny little ephemera from someone else.
It's funny because between reading that story and reading your novel, I was cleaning out my desk and I just started shoving things into books that I didn't want to throw away, but I didn't know what to do with them. And I thought, rather than just stick them in a file, I'm just going to stick them in a book, and then, you know, I'll discover them later, or I'll accidentally throw the book out and then somebody else will discover it later.
I love that idea. And even doing that even more deliberately, writing a note to yourself that hopefully you won't find for another 10 years or something.
Right.
It's a good idea.
Right. I'm also drawn to this idea of Gil. I always like to talk to authors about the time a book is released, and that this book came out, you know, kind of in the penumbra of this Me Too movement, and thinking about Gil's character and how we might view him today maybe differently than we would have viewed him even 5 years ago, or certainly 20 years ago. And this, you know, I had read that you wrote from his point of view for much of the book and then got sick of him and decided to do it from Flora and Ingrid's point of view, and how he just continually inserts himself, and how men seem to continually insert themselves in the lives of women, whether they want it or not.
Yeah, I didn't want him to be the central character, and yet somehow, although we don't hear from his point of view, he still is. They still satellite around him, and I couldn't exercise him completely from the novel. I think, obviously, it was written and conceived quite a long time before the Me Too movement, but I think it definitely still has something to say about that, because he does make an awful lot of presumptions about women, and he's very controlling, and he doesn't really, it appears that he doesn't see things from Ingrid's point of view. But of course, we do only hear Ingrid's point of view too. So, you know, she might not be completely reliable, but you have to decide who you want to side with. And I think most people would side with Ingrid in this novel.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The phones are very quiet, so I want to remind our listeners that our goal here is five callers for the hour. And I wasn't going to do this, but as an incentive, I will offer up my copy of Swimming Lessons. I hate giving books away. But if you do call and are intrigued by the book, I will offer this as a prize premium. I'll go out and buy my own copy. But anyway, for your $35 donation, you can request a copy of Claire Fuller's Swimming Lessons that we are on the air talking about right now. I also do have an extra copy that I am willing to part with of Memento Park, which will be on in the second half hour. But give us a call. Barbara's out there looking lonely, and the phone number is 949-824-5824-949-UCI-KUCI. Or you can donate online just at KUCI.org. Just mention that you're donating on behalf of our show. We appreciate that. And we have those awesome gift certificates and tax deductions and all kinds of incentives to offer you. So give us a call. Don't make Barbara look so lonely. So Claire, I also had heard that your love is in revising as opposed to writing. You like having written and you like playing with writing, but the first draft is a tough draft. And I think that's, you know, a sentiment shared by a lot of writers. And I was wondering if you could kind of talk about maybe some of the tips and tricks that you use to get yourself through a first draft. My refrigerator is never so clean as when I'm trying to work on a first draft of something. Talk a little bit about overcoming resistance.
Back away from the fridge. I find it so hard. I have to bribe myself. I do have to bribe myself with lunch to write a few more hundred words. Anything to kind of keep going and trick myself into writing. It takes me probably about a year and a half to write what might be called the first draft, except that I do some editing as I go along. So I read back what I've written the previous day, edit that a bit to kind of get back into the story. And I used to do it based on a word count. So I would tell myself I had to write 1,000 words a day. Didn't always achieve that, of course. And now I was finding that I was writing 1,000 words, which were pretty rubbish, just to try and achieve that word count. And now I let myself just write. As long as I write forward, I write some new stuff, the story is moving forward, and I'm not just filling in and editing, then that's the kind of rule I give myself. I find it tortuous writing that first draft when I don't know where things are going. And sometimes I do get stuck, and so I take myself out of that document, open a new one, and say, I head it with, we need to talk about Flora, or we need to talk about Ingrid. And then I have a written conversation with Ingrid, and I ask her questions, and she will kind of reply, and it helps me with whatever scene I'm doing. So sometimes I don't know what she wants from that conversation that she's having with somebody. And if I can go and have a written conversation with her in another document, it will sometimes provide me with answers. And that's another way that I try and keep going.
It's interesting that you say that, because I felt like that for some reason it's sometimes easier for me to write in second person. And so much of these through the letters was written in second person. And that seems like a nice way to facilitate almost a conversation with someone who, you know, the other person isn't there because it's a letter. But I wondered if that was how the letters came about, or how Ingrid got her voice heard, even though she's disappeared from the story.
The letters really came about because when I decided that I wanted to write it from Ingrid and Flora's point of view, by then I had decided that Ingrid had already disappeared. So I thought, well, how are we gonna hear from her? And so I had her write one letter, and I thought, actually, I quite like this. So it was it wasn't a plan. It was just an experiment. I thought she would just write one letter, but I carried on, and that's really how they came about.
I love the second person aspect of letters. I also want to talk to you about two things that I find hard. You said writing arguments is very difficult for you because you're not an arguer in real life. So I'd love to talk about writing arguments and writing sex, which I also think is hard for writers. And you do a great job of it. first, let's start with arguments. How, because I know that that was a challenge for you and kind of overcoming that challenge.
Yeah, I find that really difficult because I don't argue with people. I don't even feel it's really avoiding conflict. I just don't get that angry. And so my arguments, when I've written them, the dialogue, it's always seemed a bit flat and everybody always backs down and says, I'm really sorry, I still love you at the end, which obviously doesn't create an awful lot of tension and conflict in the novel. So I would write a first draft knowing that this was really weak and not going to work, and then just keep going over and over and over it and make people more and more angry, and make them throw things and stamp their feet and just to try and make it as cross as I could, really.
It's such a reveal of
have a proper argument.
Yeah, I feel like arguing and sex, there's such a reveal of character because you're very raw. You're very vulnerable. I mean, it's when all of your defenses are down or all of your emotional guards are compromised. And it seems like, you know, some of the best opportunities to reveal true emotion and true character in a way that you wouldn't get kind of in the everyday, you know, coffee shop scenes.
Absolutely, yes. The defenses are down. I think that's more... The defenses are down, certainly with sex, but in arguments there's also this kind of wall of anger as well that's projecting out. So their defenses are down, but they're also really letting their deepest emotions out.
Yeah.
I actually quite like writing sex scenes. I find them easier than arguments. But you do have to be so careful because I've read some dreadful sex scenes too, and they can just be really cheesy and awful. And so the thing I really try to do is try to make them sound as if they are any other scene. So I'm not going to suddenly start writing really descriptive metaphors or just go into a different style. I think that's the trouble that some people do. If the whole book is flowery, then write a flowery sex scene. But if it's not, if you're trying to write in quite plain prose without too many adjectives, without too many adverbs, then your sex scene has to be written in the same way, I think.
Somebody told me not to personify body parts, you know, not to focus on body parts, but to almost energize the scene around the couple, you know, the objects around the couple. You can eroticize, but don't eroticize the couple themselves.
Yeah.
I have to kind of think.
And even if you have to name a body part, it's always so difficult what term you're going to come up with, because you know there's the erotic ones or there's the ones that character might use, but I don't know, somehow writing that down, it always seems wrong. So you do have to try and avoid that too, and yet still be, if your scene is meant to be slightly erotic, then you have to, it's a fine balance between just making it really plain and making it slightly sexy.
Yeah, right. I'd also love to talk about your office, what your office looks like, because this is a complicated novel, and there's a lot of, I almost thought about it as a mobile. If one aspect of this novel moves, I guess every novel's like this, the whole thing shifts. And I wondered how you kept that all straight. If your office has big pieces of butcher paper, if you've got post-it notes all over the place, if there's just... How did you organize this?
Yeah, with this one, I didn't do any of that really. I had a timeline, So just a kind of spreadsheet, really, or a table in Word where I would have dates and what people were doing when and how old they were in relation to everybody else. So I had, you know, a column for Ingrid, a column for Gil, and a column for Flora, and one for Nan, and then the dates and what they were doing at all those different times. So that was as detailed as I got, really. But after I finished our endless number of days, and that was a dual narrative, and that was very complicated, I said, I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to write a dual narrative, and then Swimming Lessons just merged itself into that very annoyingly. But I think, you know, I kept control of it, a lot of it in my head rather than written down. But the third novel, which is out later this year, I didn't want to write a dual narrative, but I have. It just happened. And that one was a real nightmare. So I wrote lots of the scenes, or all of the scenes, on little cards, and I laid them all out on my sitting room floor, and I moved everything around because I couldn't keep it all in my head by then. So I'm writing now number four, and I'm absolutely going to make sure that it starts at one point and it finishes however many days or weeks later, and nothing else happens in between.
Well, on that note, through the course of four novels, two out, one coming out, and one in process, can you share any advice with writers on lessons gleaned through the process?
We talked about kind of writing the first draft how difficult I find that, but what I do love is the editing and the revising. And I have learned that is so important. You know, there are some people who love just getting the story down and then the editing bit is boring, but I think it's the most crucial bit. Obviously, you can't do it unless you have some words to edit, but I think you've just got to spend so much time listening to what you've written, to the musicality of it, to the rhythm of it, reading it aloud as if someone has just thrust the piece of paper in front of you and said, you've got to read this out to an audience now. Would you be happy with those words? Would you be proud of them? Is every word in the right place? Does it sound right? I think just work really hard on the editing. It does feel sometimes like, well, there's lots of books that I love, and I can tell that the author has thought about every single word in every place and how the whole thing works together. And the ones that I don't enjoy so much don't do that. It's not about the rhythm of the language, and I think that's really important.
Yeah, good advice. Claire Fuller, Swimming Lessons is the book. Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Thank you, Melanie.
Thank you. That was Claire Fuller. The book is Swimming Lessons. The phones are quiet. So I am going to implore you, give us a call, 949-824-5824. Barbara is taking your calls. We have a couple of gift certificates to bookstores. We have book giveaways, well, giveaways with your donation. And really, you know, I am such a supporter of free speech, such a supporter of free, independent, commercial-free radio. We're not backed by sponsors here. We are reliant entirely on donation dollars to keep the lights on. KUCI has been on the air since 1969, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we rely on listeners like you. So if you have enjoyed this show or any other show on KUCI, I would consider this your opportunity to give back. All of your donations are tax deductible, and we have thank you gifts to give you and in support of your dollars. So I really would appreciate your call, 949-824-5824. We're going to take a very short break. I'll be right back with Mark Sarvis in just a moment. I did happen to secure two copies of Memento Park. Mark Sarvis is on with me now, and I'm willing to part with one of them for your $35 donation. So I hate parting with books, but fortunately I have two copies. This is a winner. This book is fantastic. Rarely do I get calls from listeners before the show. I often get calls from listeners after the show saying how much they love a novel. I've been getting calls from listeners before the show saying they can't wait to have Mark on. So I'm going to bring him on now. Give us a call, 949-824-5824. Mark Sarvis is the author of the novel Harry Revised, which was published in more than a dozen countries around the world. His book reviews and criticism have appeared in the New York Times Book Review, the Three Penny Review, Book Forum, and many other publications. He's a member of the National Book Critics Circle, Pen America, and Pen Center USA. He teaches novel writing at UCLA Extension Writers Program. The Elegant Variation was his well-known literary blog, and Memento Park is the novel we're talking about this morning. It's published by FSG. It is wonderful. Mark, welcome on.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me this morning.
I shared with you, and I just shared with our listeners, that your book is getting a lot of buzz on our show. So I don't often hear from listeners before the show.
I'd like to...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
No. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I'd like to assist in your conundrum, and because I do have a number of extra copies lying around here to prevent you from having to part unnecessarily, I'm happy to send you a signed copy as part of your drive here. So I can send that off to you when we're done talking today.
Oh,
you
my
can
God.
Add that to your bag of offerings.
Love it. Love it. All right, callers, you heard it here. You get a signed copy of Mark's book, signed by the man himself, with your donation, 949-824-5824. That's very generous. Thank you so much. So I'm going to let you take us into this world for people. Some of our listeners have read it, obviously. Some perhaps have not. So I'm going to let you take us into Matt's world and talk a little bit about the novel to kind of set the stage.
Sure. excuse me. I'm recovering, unfortunately, from a cold, so I might be a little coughing here today. There's another one.
I think we all are.
Memento Park is a novel about an L.A. area actor who becomes aware of a painting that he believes was looted from his family during the Second World War. But in order to recover this painting, he essentially has to recover his family's lost past, the narrative of what happened to his family in Hungary during the war. He has to recover his relationship with his father, which is in considerable disrepair. He has to recover his relationship with his own religious self, with his own Judaism, which is non-existent. So it's a novel that's moving a number of sort of narrative and thematic threads forward at once, all the while he's trying to recover this painting that's worth several million dollars and is potentially life-changing for him.
So this is a book that has been in your mind for longer than you wrote it. It was a book I read that you kind of put in a drawer and marinated on for some years. So talk about the origin idea and your decision to prolong writing it.
Sure. It's funny. One of the things that has sort of come out as I've been on the tour for this book that frustrates me ever so slightly is, sadly, I can't remember the actual moment of inspiration. For most of the things I've written, I can usually go back and say that's the thing that triggered it. And with this one, I really can't. I had written a short story in the mid-90s called The Number, and it's a story about a man whose infant son is born with a number tattooed on his arm, and he has to understand what that means. And in the author bio in the magazine that published that story, it said, Mark is working on a novel about looted Nazi art. So clearly the idea had been with me for a long time, and I collected a number of art books and books about restitution and looted art. But as I started to get serious about writing my first novel, which was around 2002, 2003, I realized that I wasn't good enough yet. I didn't have the chops, if you will, to write the kind of book that I envisioned this novel to be. And so I kind of wrote what we call my training novel. I mean, it's not to take anything away from Harry Revised. I was very happy with the book, and it was an acceptable first effort. But it was really the book in which I learned a lot of the techniques that I came back, and then when I thought I was ready, I returned to the idea of Memento Park and started serious work on it in the beginning of 2009.
I kind of want to unpack that answer because that's interesting. The things that you learned from the first novel, like what do you think Harry Revised taught you well, you know, was it about character or about structure or about voice that that carried you through to this book?
Well, most importantly, it taught me that I could do it. You know, whenever you're writing a first novel, and I teach novel writing at UCLA, and most of the students in my class are working on their first novels, and so they don't have that sort of confidence that you can actually get to the end of something, that it will hold together, it'll cohere, and, you know, God willing, somebody might even want to give you some money for it. So in a lot of ways, it was a confidence-building exercise, but along the way, I was really working firsthand, sort of developing these narrative strategies. You know, I'm interested in novels that tell the story in an unusual way, and I'm not terribly interested in the standard linear chronological narrative. I'm interested in things that mess up the timeline a bit. And so, in Harry Revised, although the bulk of the book moves forward, there is this sort of recurrent series of flashbacks that actually unfold in reverse chronological order. And so, you know, even from that first book, I was sort of playing with time, and I had ambitions about how to mess with story. And it was comforting to get to the end and realize, okay, you know, I can do this. This process has now been a bit demystified for me. It's still hard and demanding and time-consuming, but it's certainly not out of reach. And I think I needed that confidence to wade into the deeper waters of Memento Park.
So we should share with our listeners kind of how this novel is set up. It's the real-time narrative is really over the course of one night, with our hero telling his story, our protagonist telling his story to kind of an off-camera gentleman. And then the story is really kind of told in flashback. And I was wondering myself if that structure was always there. It's hard to hear the name Virgil, who is the man that he's relaying the story to, without thinking of Dante for me.
which is intended. So
right.
You know, it worked exactly as planned. Yes, his imagined conversation partner is this night watchman. The novel opens. He is standing in the auction house the night before his painting is about to be auctioned off. And he's sort of communing with the painting for one final night, if you will. And there's this security guard wandering around, and his patch on his shirt says the company name Vigil, but he takes it to be Virgil. And in his mind, he has this sort of extended monologue with Virgil as he revisits the events of the novel. And, you know, I'm always very interested in, you know, Memento Park makes the choice to begin the story at the end. So by the time we join Matt in the auction house, the events of the narrative have transpired. He knows all the facts of the narrative. What he doesn't know yet is what they mean. He hasn't really sussed out the meaning of it. And so it is in revisiting the narrative across this long final night with Virgil as his imagined sympathetic listener that he can start to tease out the meaning of the things that happened to him. And it's a structure that really owes a considerable debt to John Banville and the novel The Book of Evidence, which is a confession narrative told by a man who's been arrested for a terrible murder. And so he's in his prison cell sort of writing out his imagined confession for the judge. And I was very taken by that form. And so, as all good writers will do, I stole it and used it for my own book.
I'm just thinking out loud here. I hadn't thought of this before this moment, but isn't the movie Memento, isn't that the name of the movie where it's also a revisiting of time? It's a forgetting novel, or a forgetting movie, but it's, I think that's the name of it. Anyway, it's a...
Yeah, Memento. I think that was an early Christopher Nolan movie, which, right. You know, I'm embarrassed to say that I actually haven't seen, but I know the premise. You know, I think he's got these tattoos that are there to remind him of things from his past, so It's another novel of memory, and an early working title for this novel was Mementos, just when I was scratching away at it, and a writer friend of mine pointed out that, you know, people will confuse that with the Christopher Nolan movie, and I told him that, well, I'm getting the word memento from Memento Park, which is this wonderful tourist attraction in Budapest where they've sort of deposited all of the old Stalin-era statues, and the pivotal scene of the novel happens, and he looked at me and he said, well, of course, you have to call the novel Memento Park. So that came from somebody else.
So great. So great. I want to talk a little bit about the opening. So the opening, which is what some other listeners have pointed out, is so deftly done. You have kind of the bulk of the novel right there in the first few pages. And I think novel openings are tricky, and I wanted to talk about kind of how that came about, if you wrote the novel and then went back to write the beginning after the novel was written, or you know, just kind of talk about those first 10 to 12 pages.
Sure. Well, it's there's a quote I remember reading from, again, I Return to Banville. He's an important writer in my pantheon. But he once said in an interview that he spends an inordinate amount of time on the first paragraph of his novels, and that the first paragraph will tell you how to read the book, in essence, you know, how to approach this particular narrative. And that had always stuck with me. For me, the journey to writing a novel always starts with voice. I'm very voice-driven, and I can't really get any traction on an idea until I know what the narration sounds like. And so I had gone up to this little place I like to hole away up near Monterey to spend a few days writing. And Matt really did just sort of start speaking to me on that trip. And he was in this place. I didn't know why this place was important, but he was in that situation of standing in front of the painting. So a lot of that stuff arrived very instinctively. And then it was only in revision where I was able to sort of dial that in and tailor it. And as you say, sort of lay out the groundwork for the novel. I'm always on my students about, you know, exposition and setup and how it needs to be done sort of quickly and deftly and with as little backstory and encumbrance as possible, so that you can have the reader enter the world of the story very quickly. And so that was something that I was very focused on. And I was actually listening to your last caller before we jumped on at the end of her interview, where she talked about how, you know, for her the process comes in the revision, and it's in the sort of refining of what comes out in the first draft. And it was very similar there. As it, oftentimes, you're correct, the thing that a reader reads in a published book is not the first thing that the reader wrote. In this particular case, that opening in the auction house was, in fact, the first thing I wrote back in January of 2009. But then the things in the subsequent pages that are sort of getting the story up and underway and establishing the relationships, those all evolved across the course of several drafts. And I do a lot of revision, as most of the writers I know do.
I do think middles are very difficult. I think, you know, sustaining momentum and sustaining reader interest and all of those things, all the tricks that you have to pull out of your writerly bag come up in the middle of novels. I mean, the beginnings, you can pull somebody in, but sustaining them, I think, is tough. So your point there is well taken. I think that's...
Middles are nightmarish. the part that every writer dreads, you know. In the beginning, you've got all your energy and enthusiasm, and you're in love with your new idea, and then as you're writing the closing of the third act or the end, you've got the momentum and you can sort of see the finish line, and so you pick up the pace. But in that middle, you're lost half the time, and you have no idea if it's working or not, or, you know, if you've lost the thread or not. It is a very difficult and not always pleasant place to be. So
exactly right. My guest this morning is Mark Sarvis. The book is Memento Park. I've heard some phone ring. I haven't gotten an update, so I don't know if we still have Mark's book available, but call us anyway, and we'll make sure that you get a copy of Mark's book if you wish it, or gift certificates or whatever else. 949-824-5824. I'd love to talk about this father-son relationship, because it's so well done and so heartbreaking. And I was wondering if there was a character in here, if that character was the father, was Gil, who gave you more trouble than other characters, and kind of mining not only character but also mining relationships, and whether that relationship was organic or whether it took a lot of work. Just talk a little bit about that.
Sure. As it happens, there was absolutely a character who vexed me through many drafts, and that's the character of Matt's fiance, Tracy. Who I think had been named three other things before, which is usually a sign that you're flailing a little bit with the character. And I knew when I'd written the first draft already that she was a failed a failed creation, and for pretty obvious reasons, you know, the central one being that I wasn't terribly interested in her in the first draft. She wasn't my focus of my energy, so, you know, Matt and his dad got the lion's share of my energy in that first draft. And when I finished that first draft, I stepped back and I thought, wow, this character is atrocious. And so I spent an entire draft, the entire first revision or second draft was all centered around trying to figure out Tracy and trying to bring her to life. And I ended up, as a lot of a trick, again, that a lot of writers use, was I patterned her after somebody who I knew. The character of Tracy, these two people live in Los Angeles. They're both sort of moderately successful in their fields. They're not by any means at the top of their game, but they make a living. Matt sort of as an actor playing these unnamed characters on TV series, and Tracy is a model, but sort of a model for, you know, Penny and Sears as opposed to Victoria's Secret or anything fancy. I knew somebody who had done that sort of work, and so I ended up interviewing her really with an eye toward just getting physical details of the daily life, you know, what it's like to be, for example, on a shoot and what goes through a person's head. But in talking to her, I suddenly had the thought that, oh, my gosh, I can actually use her as the basis of a character. And that started to bring her to life more fully for me. There were also, you know, I always tell my students that you're much smarter than you realize, and your subconscious is always looking out for you. And any problems that you find you have, if you look through the breadcrumbs of the first draft, chances are that the solution's already there if you can notice it and pick it up. And what I always had about Tracy from the first draft was the fact that she and Matt's father get along so well, whereas Matt and his father did not. And that sort of intrigued me when I stepped back and I thought, I wonder why that is. You know, and I took a decision that had been an instinctive choice and used that as a way to start to work into character and bring her to life. So, but it took several drafts to get her, you know, anything approaching right.
I'm so glad you said that nugget about your subconscious being the smartest part of being a writer, because I do think that the more we rely on our subconscious, the more interesting the novel is going to be. That stuff bubbles out of there that the reader can never guess at, because the writer can never guess at, because it comes from some ethereal place. And it is the smartest part of novel writing. I think that's the risk of being an outliner, right, is that you tamp down all that wonderful subconscious stuff that you get if you have no idea what the hell's going to come next in your novel. So
And that's sort of my objection toward, you know, my critique of my first novel, because I came at it, I'd been a screenwriter, and so outlining was what I knew, and so I outlined the novel, and as a result, it always feels a little overdetermined to me, mm-hmm. And my favorite part of that first novel is something that emerged in the writing that wasn't in the outline, you know, an unexpected friendship that sort of reared up that I hadn't planned on, and so I learned to be wary of outlines, and as you say, to sort of trust that subconscious instinctive place.
Tell me about your research process. Did a lot of research, did you travel to Budapest? Kind of tell me a little bit about mining out this artist in the book.
Sure. Well, you know, Memento Park has a bibliography at the back, uh-huh. Which is, I guess, unusual for novels. But there were so many books that I relied on that I really did want to sort of credit them. And you know, in the end, I think my research broke down into about three or four tracks. There was just sort of understanding the whole world of looted art and restitution, and that was one set of inquiries, if you will, and with its associated reading. Then there was sort of reconnecting to my own lapsed Jewish heritage, and I'm a secular American raised by first-generation immigrant parents, and I had no real connection to, you know, being an American Jew or a Jew of any kind. And so I had to do considerable research on that front. And so there was a lot of reading in that end. And then there was also a lot of reading around my my painter. The painter in the novel is a fictional painter, and the painting is fictionalized. But it is based very closely on the life and the work of the German expressionist painter Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, who painted a famous series of Berlin street scenes. And so I very, very cleverly renamed them Budapest street scenes and put those into my novel. But I wanted to know his life and his work more fully. And then, yes, as you suspect, I also did take a research trip to Budapest. My family's from Hungary, and I visited often as a child, but I hadn't been in more than a decade. And I just, what I found as I was trying to write the Budapest pages really was that my sense memory was stale. And so I couldn't write, I knew where things were, and I knew how, Hungarian society conducted itself, but I didn't know, what the streets smelled like when you walked down, what was the quality of light like in the National Gallery. And so I hopped on a plane, spent 5 maddening days with relatives back in Budapest, and collected the information that I needed to then finish the Budapest pages with some authority.
It's killing me. We're running out of time because I have about 80 more questions. But but I do always like to ask how, over the course of this novel, what this novel taught you. It sounds like the first novel taught you a lot. What this novel taught you that you will take into the future and perhaps impart wisdom onto our listeners who are writers themselves.
Sure, and there's two things. I was actually a little prepared for this one because I did hear that. I heard you ask your last guest the same question, so I had been thinking about it. But the two things are, the first is that I recently actually wrote an essay for the Jewish Book Council website where I talked about first drafts and how I think a lot of beginning writers really stumble in the world of the first draft because they expect too much from it. And that expectation leads to a kind of choking up, and I think that one must banish one's internal editor as much as possible in the first draft, because the first draft is really, it is nothing more than the back of the napkin sketch. It is a proof of concept as to whether the conception of the novel has potential, and all the work, as your prior guest said, happens in revision. So, I wrote this novel without an outline. I jumped around. I wrote whatever I saw that day. I didn't worry about how it fit. I didn't try to understand what it meant. I just wrote and wrote and wrote. And eventually, like a snowball rolling down a hill, it started to develop a critical mass. And then I could see where the story was and make those connections. So I think stepping back and just having no vanity or expectation from the first draft is really important. And then the other thing is that I've been saying for years in my classrooms, but I only experienced it firsthand in this novel, that if your work doesn't surprise you, it will not surprise your reader. Yeah. And I, again, that's back to that question of outlining or overdetermined. There's a twist to turn in this novel that we won't spoil on the phone, but that the New York Times Book Review singled out this past weekend. And that is a turn in the narrative that I did not plan and I did not see coming, and I was just writing and thinking, and I think I was taking a walk that afternoon, and this thing popped into my head, and it completely caught me off guard and it surprised me, and I realized, back to the point of the subconscious, that all the seeds for it were already here in the work. It's not like I needed to go back and change a lot to prepare for that moment, and because it surprised me, it has without fail surprised almost every reader who has picked up the book. And so I've really come to see that the power of, as I say, trusting in that thing that catches you unexpectedly, and know that that's not just a gift for you, but it will be a gift for the reader as well.
Exactly right. I love that. Mark Sarvis, this was so great. I could talk to you for another 2 hours, but we're out of time.
So could I. This has been wonderful. I'm sorry it's so brief.
I
but
know.
This is great.
Me too. Thank you so much. The novel is Memento Park, and we have a copy of it here available for your call. Mark, thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mark Sarvis, the book Memento Park. I am going to stick around until 1 o'clock today. I just found out. I just signed up to do phones. So if you call in the next 3 hours, I'm going to hang out. And I will continue to offer Mark's book if you call in the name of Writers on Writing. And we might have given it away, but I'll give you my copy. We'll make sure you get a copy of Mark's book if you want it. And that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining me. Give me a call, 949-824-5824. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Richard Bosch is with me for the full hour. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.